2010, in my mind, was an important year because it taught everyone who cares, which is almost everyone, that this is one of the worst economic crises the United States has ever had. It's on a scale with the Great Depression. It's not going away real soon. And people settled in 2010 to face that. Didn't know quite what to do about it, but to face it. 2011 is the great transition year, in my opinion, because in that year, over the first two-thirds of it, people began to get more and more angry about what was going on, about this lasting crisis, and the fact that little was being done for most people to do anything to limit the damage or to reverse the situation. And then, of course, the crucial thing, which we'll always look back to, is the Occupy Wall Street movement that explodes starting in September of 2011, and that really changes everything. It changes the way people feel about the economic crisis. Suddenly there's a movement to do something. It isn't coming from the top. It's coming from below. It has incredible staying power against clumsy efforts by incompetent governmental agencies to control it, which only makes it seem stronger and more durable, and it attracts many more people. It's clearly a very, very popular movement right from the beginning, thereby giving the lie to those who had felt and thought and said that there's no left-wing base in the United States, that was all blown away. Millions of Americans who thought they were the only person who thought a certain way discovered they weren't. So I think 2012 will be the legacy year, the year in which a long-lasting crisis and the beginning of a serious movement to do something about it that is not paid by the big corporations, not in league with the Republican or Democratic parties, begins to assert a new and independent political perspective. And so I expect great things from 2012 that are going to build on the Occupy movement, whatever forms the organizations take, whether we see the revival of old radical organizations, a development of new ones, a little bit of both, that will be very interesting to watch. Even how old terms like capitalism and socialism and all, whether they stay in circulation, what new meanings they take on, it's going to be a very exciting political year of change, in which the major news will not be the political shenanigans around election. It'll be about a new political constellation in this country that's developing.
So when you talk about Occupy, that it's a movement to do something, what is that something? Or what are those some things, plural?
Well, I think that the Occupy movement has been nothing short of genius in how it's developed. I tell people who ask me that had they asked me, they didn't, but had they asked me early on what to do, I would have given them awful advice, and nothing makes me happier than the fact that they never asked me so that they never had to even risk following my bad advice. The first advice I would have given them would have been to be very clear about what they want. Wrong. What they needed to do was gather together all sorts of people with all sorts of agendas to teach them a fundamental lesson about politics. If you're going to make change, you have to get people who disagree on all kinds of things to trust each other and to work together. That's the hardest thing, because that's the way the left in the past has been splintered in this country. And to do what they did, to come up with a set of very general slogans like 1% versus 99%, or being angry at the businesses or questioning capitalism or the basic themes that they developed, was exactly the right thing. It is a big tent. It allows all kinds of people to get together, to work together, to get to know each other, to understand their differences, not be threatened by them, see the differences as a very important glue that can hold them together. So I think this is a movement that has stunningly understood and incorporated fundamental political lessons about gathering people together under conditions that are very bad for that sort of thing, in a country that militates against that through its individualism, through its long history of single-issue movements that have been very leery of mixing together with other people and so forth. The second thing that Occupy does that's a game changer and brilliant was its courage and determination against all kinds of advice, not just the kind I would have given them, to put the question of economic inequality, of the economic system, of capitalism, right out front, right at the beginning, no holds barred. We're the 99%. Our adversary is the 1%. They control the economy. They've bought the political system. They're the problem. We're going to have to change all that. That has been something the vast majority of left-leaning movements in America have been terrified of for half a century. Whether you call that the legacy of the Cold War, or whether you call that the legacy of the anti-communism of the early parts of the Cold War, whatever you call it, it has immobilized and undermined left movements in this country for half a century. And they dealt with that by not beating around the bush, not hiding, not prevaricating, but putting it right out front. And instead of that being a problem of frightening people away, it had exactly the opposite effect, which is only sign of genius in politics there ever is. The proverbial, you run that flag up the pole and you see who salutes. Occupy gathered people around a whole network of vague issues, multiple issues, general principles, and it put the economic question forefront. Nobody would have suggested they do those two things. That's not the way the left has in general behaved. And so they have, to their credit, as a movement, achieved two major breakthroughs, changing politics. That's why in such a short time everybody was talking about 1%, 99%. It wasn't too radical to say. Even the president had to say it. Even some of those Republican jerks had to say it. That's a sign that you have really tapped into popular consciousness. And for a left in this country to have done that so quickly, so successfully, stunning. The only answer is stunning. And a movement with that much to go for it in a few short months is a movement we're going to hear more about, whatever the particular forms that may take.
And when you talk about Occupy really touching a nerve, it seems like there's some interesting variety both in genesis and execution when you go from geographically across the country. I wonder, since you've visited a lot of Occupies, tell us a story about what you've seen and just what you see as sort of the variegations in this movement.
Well, it's enormously dispersed. You're absolutely right. The ones I've talked to, for example, range from a small city, Bangor, in Maine, to San Rafael in Marin County, north of San Francisco, and a whole bunch in between. And actually, the most often I visited and spoke was at Zuccotti Park in Wall Street, since I work and live in that area. They're both similar and different. Similar in the sense of the Occupy thematic being very meaningful to all of them across the board. The 1%, 99% everywhere, uniformly adopted as a slogan, as a focus, very, very interesting. The differences, well, my first reaction is they have a bit more to do with geography and the specifics of each city and locality where it was done. Cities and towns are different. Let me give you an example. In New York City, the decision of the mayor there, a non-entity named Bloomberg, who, by the way, is the living incarnation of a famous Peter Sellers film called Being There. If you remember that film, there's a man in there named Chauncey Gardner who becomes president of the United States because he's the right man in the right place at the right time, even though he's clearly retarded. I'm not saying that Bloomberg is exactly the same, but it sure is similar. So Mr. Bloomberg decides to cope with Zuccotti Park by endlessly throwing police personnel so that they ring the park, that they stand there, that they make noise with their sirens, that they forbid the use of voice microphones and things like that. Endless harassment because that's the only way that the 1% know how to cope with it. They can't answer any of the criticisms. They can't deal with any of the issues. So they repress. That's what they know. And the spectacle, for example, of Mrs. Clinton celebrating freedom-fighting folks demanding democracy in every other country while systematically conniving here to repress the pale image of what's happening there, here, is as stunning to everybody as you can imagine. So in New York City, it's all about resisting repression, resisting the police, and you have a spectacle, for example, in which the mayor, Bloomberg, destroys his own political career in one act by emptying the park violently, taking a violent action by forcing the people to leave, taking bulldozers, for example, and destroying the little public library that had been erected in Zuccotti Park. And no one missed it. You destroy a free public library as the mayor of a city. You claim this is necessary at the same time that you, as the mayor of the same city, are cutting back public library hours. And the whole thing is justified, this was stunning, by the need to clean the park. This is the mayor who presides over the filthiest subway system on earth, who has done nothing whatsoever to clean the subway system for the millions of people who risk illness by the rats and the garbage. I live there, so I know that is in that subway system. Every New Yorker who looked at that mayor articulating the cleanliness argument knew that he had as stunning a liar in front of him as any you've ever heard. It's the end for him. It's the end of his political career. Even his billions can't fix the damage he did to himself. Then compare that to Marin County, San Rafael. I give a talk in the middle of the city plaza of San Rafael. 125, 150 people gathered there. Very impressive. This is a small city, San Rafael, heaven knows, in a fairly widely dispersed county, so it's a bit of travel for people to come. So you have 150 people come. They come for 2 to 3 hours. I speak for an hour and 40 minutes, stretching my credulity and my time. There's not a single policeman in sight. There are no policemen anywhere in the neighborhood. There's no repression. There's not even the vain hint of one or two to keep the traffic flowing, nor was there the slightest need for it. And when I asked about it, because it was stunning, I learned again, there's no need here. They have a very good relationship with the local police. They have had these rallies. It's all taken care of. They are exercising their free rights. They're doing it effectively. And I think the thing that most struck me was in the next day's newspaper, the Independent Journal, I believe it's called, the newspaper, the daily paper up there, had all I can describe it. It's a story I might have written myself about my own talk in the sense of being friendly and understanding and capturing the basic. Very different from New York, in which all the major newspapers sought from the beginning to crush this by saying nothing or saying snide, dismissive kinds of reports until it became so big they couldn't anymore. And then they split. The New York Times began to talk about it by mixing. One day a story friendly, the next day a story despicably dismissive, whereas the Post and the News, which are, you know, broadside papers and scandal-mongering sheets, they basically attack it all the time. But since they attack everything left of Attila the Hun, no one takes it all terribly seriously. So it varies by the specific conditions. What Kwan did in Oakland is obviously very different from what the police did there, from what you had in Bangor, Maine. There were no police. Everybody went down to the center of Bangor, Maine to talk with the people in the tents. It had exactly the effect you would want. An issue that would otherwise only have been talked about in private became a public issue. So I think the different experiences are powerfully important. They're teaching local activists not only that they're not alone, not only who their friends and allies are, not only how to build a movement with people who disagree with you on this or that and agree with you on that, but they're also teaching people what the unique conditions of their social environment are and how to deal with those. And so I think you're accumulating very valuable experience that as this movement matures and grows will be communicated from one Occupy to another and build up that reservoir of experience that makes all successful social movements able to move forward over time. And that's what's happening here. And because they're not coming out of the old left, because they're not coming out of fairly defined and often quite rigid hostilities amongst little groups, they're not held back by all of that. In a peculiar way, while there are costs to that, they don't have the accumulated experience you might have if you were part of an ongoing political party that had been around for 50 years, that handed down lots of stories about past experiences with a strike or a demonstration. Those are valuable. Those teach people like anything else. That is missing, and sometimes that hurts and leads people to make mistakes. But you have to blend that with the enormous advantage of not having baggage to carry, being open to see and feel your way without blinders that come from history. So it's a mixed bag. We shouldn't be afraid of facing what the costs are, but we shouldn't miss the advantages of kind of starting anew. If I could say a word about that too. I'm often asked the difference between the European fighting against the austerity programs there and the American. And the basic difference is what I just referred to. It's organization. In the European context, there are long-standing socialist parties, many of them, green parties, communist parties, anti-capitalist parties, trade unions, different trade unions, members of different national associations of trade. All of those are dense networks of people who know each other, who've worked together, who understand their differences. When one group in a place, say, like France, and the same is true of Italy or Norway or Germany and so forth, one group makes a decision that something is so outrageous it needs a demonstration, 500 phone calls are made in the next 2 hours, and 10,000 people show up because they're being called by someone they've worked with for 40 years, someone they trust, someone they know, someone they understand will be there with 10 other people. Those networks are invaluable. They are the glue that holds together. The fact that in the United States those political parties have been destroyed or reduced to tiny little groups, and the fact that our labor union movement is at the end of a 50-year period of continuous decline means we don't have those networks and we don't have those capacities. That's why it's taken longer to mount these kinds of demonstrations. That's why it's taken longer for there to be an Occupy. So those are costly weaknesses of the American left. But the flip side is we don't have to inherit the hostilities of these groups to one another. We don't have to inherit their compromises, their compromised leaders, a whole lot of baggage that comes with them. So I think that the weakness has already shown up here in that it took longer for us to react. Now the strength is going to show up, that without the baggage, we're going to build those networks of relationships, those dense combinations of people who know and trust each other. That's already happening very quickly. And I think, therefore, we will show some strength in the rate of growth, even though it took us longer to get going.